then all of a sudden I'm unlocking the referee's door. I'm aware of this man charging up the tunnel. You're not cheering now, are you? You're not cheering now. And there was Jim Gannon standing behind me as I'm unlocking the the referee door. And I'm thinking, excuse me, you're the manager of the Motherwell. Are you out there and celebrate with your own team?
And welcome to another episode of the CSI Football Podcast, where we embark on a forensic delve into a particular season of football, usually with a tartan tint. I am your host, Ian Stephen, and for today's episode, we meet a man who, if you cut him open, he bleeds red and white. I realise those are the colours of your blood cells and it dilutes the analogy, but he fulfilled one of the most important roles in a football club and is a walking encyclopedia of all things Accies. It's former Hamilton Club Secretary Scott Struthers. Scott, how are you, sir?
Not too bad, Ian. Doing well, thanks.
Please, could you explain to us what the role of a club secretary is? Because it's vital to every single football club, but you work in the shadows very much like an emo superhero.
Yeah, still am club secretary, so I've been here many, many years. First began coming to the club 79-80 and then began working here in 1983 and took over as secretary in 91 and done various roles since in club licensing, youth academy admin, all sorts of things. The club secretary's role basically is the day-to-day football admin organisation side of things at a football club, be it player registrations, contract, up-to-date with disciplinary matters, potential sanctions, club licensing matters, the match organisation for the weekend games, liaising with the other teams, the league, the SFA, etc. as appropriate, and then all the people you need to you work with you to organise a match, be it the safety officers, be it the commercial side, just so that you're in touch with everything that's happening in the listen to the actual match organisation, and then you're on top of all the basically admin that leads up to the match itself too.
Is the club secretary a position that rarely rotates because managers change every couple of years, there's board takeovers all over the place? Does traditionally the secretary, is he the guy that, or she the guy that needs to stay because they know everything behind the scenes?
Yeah, there's a lot of continuity. As you say, there are some that are here a year and gone a year, and it happens there's been a few in the past season like that as well. There's others that are extremely long term, like myself, plus 40 years. Clyde at Groundshed here, John Taylor's been more than 50 years at Clyde and 40 as club secretary, for example. Down at Berwick Rangers, unfortunately, in the Lowland League now, Dennis McCleary's since 1970 secretary at Berwick. David McGregor was 45 years at Forfar Athletic. Donnie McBean at Ross County, been there since 1966, retired now, but still at Matt Davis club ambassador. And Jim up at Inverness, Cali Thistle as well. He was at Inverness Thistle previously prior to coming to Cali Thistle, the Mers team, Jim Faulkner. He's been there more than 40 years as well. So there's a few that are 40 years plus, and there's obviously others that start out by very necessity of the people retire at the other end, people start as well.
You look at a club like Manchester United, who had like over 1,000 staff members, and they realise they needed to cull. Those 1,000 roles, how many hats do you think you wear? Is it about 900 you should fill out?
Probably quite a few, because you're dealing with the club secretary role, you're dealing with club licensing, you're also dealing with sort of like a support liaison type role, you're dealing with them like you're part of the safety team too and contributing to the safety team as well. So there's lots of different roles. You're player liaison, you're trying to make sure the manager's got. I always say the ultimate role of the club secretary is that the manager has as little to worry about come 3 o'clock on a Saturday as possible. All he's got to do is pick a team and win the game, basically. As simple as that sounds, and people have to realise that football is a very simple game. So my job is to make sure that all the players he's going to select are indeed eligible to play, that they're properly signed, they're not suspended, all these things. And with the new SFA Comet system, you know, it's requiring an awful lot of double checking now, and the systems that we've had and we used to for many, many years aren't there now. And there's maybe a lot more delving in to try and double check everything. But the idea is that you should always be on top of things. If a player's in 5 bookings, he's net bookings, going to keep him out for a game, let the player and the manager know, you know, in good time. Don't tell him at 5-3, by the way, you get booked today and you're out next week. You know, it doesn't quite work like that. Let the player know on the Tuesday, Wednesday, by the way, you're on 5 bookings, your next booking, you miss a game. It's just wee things like that, so that everyone's fully aware and nobody's getting any surprises. And then really it's ensuring the players are up to date with the essential SFA rules, for example, betting would be a topical topic, things like that, to make sure the players, so they're not caught out, basically. Your job to make sure that the manager and the players shouldn't or don't break the rules.
Well, every single story starts at a beginning, Scott. So where were you born and brought up, and who was your boyhood club?
Born actually in Brighton, in England, despite the fact I'm covered in Scotland tattoos and things like that. My mum comes from Brighton. My dad was a teacher of French and German. So as a student, he'd live for a year abroad in France and a year abroad in Germany. So my mum not knowing anybody up here for me with her parents down there, which is why I was born down in Brighton at that time. Brought up, we moved up to Glasgow very, very shortly afterwards. My dad was a student in Glasgow. And we lived in Byers Road for a couple of years in Govan Hill before coming out to Uddingston in 1968. So I lived in Uddingston since 1968, brought up there, very much a Lanarkshire boy. Nearest team to my house is Thornywood United, and nearest senior team is Hamilton Accies. And first came here to visit the Gold Douglas Park about 78, 79, and began coming to games the following season, and worked here since 1983.
So you're eligible to represent the English FA?
Only technically.
I went to the old Douglas Park Stadium when I was younger. I remember it fondly. And there was a transition between the old Douglas Park and the new Douglas Park that were built in, we're sitting in just now, being built. Are you enough of a historian to be able to actually say why there was such a delay? Because there was rumours about all Accies had was a minibus to their name, and it wasn't a very successful period for the club.
It wasn't, no, although during the middle of that, though, we did have a fantastic promotion season from the third tier, whatever it was called in those days, Division 2, 96-97. We had a fantastic season with Paul Witchie scoring an absolute barnload of goals that season too. It was ultimately 6.5, 7 years homeless. The last league game took place at Old Douglas Park in May 1994. It was in use the following season. People forget that. It was still in use the following season for all our reserve games up until the January youth games. It was used by a whole host of other teams as well. Rangers, Celtic, Motherwell, Partick Thistle, St Johnstone, etc. all used it to host reserve games as well because it wasn't doing anything else. So it hosted many, many games in that 94-5 season. We spent two seasons at Partick Thistle, two seasons at Albion Rovers, and a further three at Partick Thistle in the 7 years that we were homeless. Whole host of reasons for it. The main one being that the board of directors was split just the way the shareholding was at that time. It was like split 55-45 one way, and then you somebody moved on or passed, and the shareholding went the other way, 55-45 the other way. So it was a very split board at that time. They all had designs on what they wanted to see as the future of Hamilton Accies. Also at that time too, the then SPL requirements were 10,000 covered seats, which is why Airdrie, who were also homeless at the same period, but for 4 years compared to our seven, that's why Airdrie's Excelsior Stadium had 10,000 seats now, most of which unfortunately sit unused at Airdrie's games because that was the rules that it was designed for at the time. And of course, Airdrieonians, as was subsequent into administration just a couple of years later as well, after they moved into their new stadium. So Hamilton really had some directors that wanted to build what we can see today, basically a two-stand structure with office space within it. And others wanted to build a traditional four-sided football ground, be it 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000, whatever. The directors, though, football doesn't exist now solely on gate money. And the view back then was that they needed office space, a rental income, that kept the stadium and the club going to pay the bills. Because if you look at Old Douglas Park, you didn't have any lighting in the terraces or, day-to-day, whereas in modern stands now, the household, the ground stand we're in now is all lit up, all three floors. You didn't have three floors in old stands, you didn't have three floors in terraces. And as these were all replaced by the new modern stadium, they all required electricity and heat and light in all the areas of the stadium because it's not just in use on a match day. So the costs skyrocketed as Airdrie found out, as Hamilton found out, things like that. But it was really just different designs that the various boards and directors had at that time, and it was a struggle for control of the club. And it wasn't nice. There was a particularly nasty period, 1999-2000 season. The club was financially troubled, wages weren't paid, players went in strike, 15 points were deducted. And it caused real problems with supporters, players against the board. There was no cooperation at all. There was obstructiveness. You would find players getting paid. People still paid by cheque in those days. It wasn't instant bank transfers as we have your telephone in 5 seconds nowadays. The players would be paid, say, at 5 to 4 on a Friday, and they weren't going to get to the bank before it closed at 4 o'clock to cast a cheque. But by the time they did be able to cast a cheque, the money, the club's paid in the gate money from the Saturday. So it's wee things like that that were just, you've been paid, but unfortunately you can't cash it till Monday. It was just wee things like that that led to a complete breakdown in relationship with, the staff, the club, supporters, all sorts of things. Supporters, rallied round too and contributed money here and there as well. But it was not a nice time. It was a very poor period, probably the lowest point in the club's history. And it was really my task to basically try and hold the whole thing together, be the pot of glue that held it all together. And to pass it on to whoever in due course.
Well, I mean, the transformation of Accies has been quite remarkable from where they were, and they've had periods of sustained success. One of the more colourful periods, though, we chatted about it briefly before, was the fact that you were here when John Lambie was the Accies. Do you have fond memories of John being involved in the club?
John was a fantastic guy. He was the first, I knew the previous manager, worked with him, but John was the first one that had a good, you know, working relationship with you for the 84 to 88, 4.5 years when he was managing here. And then came back for 6 months the following season, and there was a pre-Bosman days, there was a movement in managers, and John Lambie went from Hamilton to Partick to Hamilton to Partick and so on, you know, about three times in about, four times in about two seasons. But John was your camel coat, cigar-smoking manager on a match date, which you just simply just don't have nowadays at all. It was very common in England, your Malcolm Allisons and others in the English leagues at that time too. Your old-fashioned, old-school manager who would stand at the side of training. But John was maybe one of the first managers too to transition to wearing a tracksuit top. But training was a remarkable change for John, for example. But John was an old-fashioned coach. He'd been a coach at Hibernian under Bertie Auld and John Blackley and a few others there. He'd learned his trade under Eddie Turnbull and some of the classic Hibs coaches in the 70s and 80s. So John knew his stuff, and John was a very, very good coach. And it was Bertie Auld that had brought John here as his assistant. You know, Bertie would just, again, cigar-smoking, camel coat, legend of the Scottish game, sadly passed a year or so ago. But Bertie brought in John here, so it was Bertie that we actually thank for John Lambie's arrival and development as a manager. And Bertie was dismissed in January 84, and John was appointed manager. And such was the weather and the postponements at that time. His first game as manager was a Thursday night Scottish Cup tie at Old Douglas Park against Alloa, which Hamilton won 3-1, and that was the first game of the John Lambie era. I think it was the 2nd of February in 1984. But the game was famously remembered because Jock Wallace had just taken over again as Rangers manager, and Jock Wallace was in the crowd that day, and he then signed the Alloa left-back Stuart Munro for £15,000 straight after the game, and Stuart Munro went on to have a distinguished career at Rangers in the mid-80s too.
Well, you're mentioning a Rangers fullback there. You've also had a Rangers fullback that was manager here, Ali Dawson was here, but just before him, you did the spell with Ian Munro, where there was success at the club as well. Was that a fond kind of time to look back on?
Yeah, Ian was more than well known to me. He naturally used to be my babysitter. Ian's also an Uddingston boy, and my dad had also taught him at school. But Ian had babysat me and my family quite a few times in the mid-70s and early 70s when he was still just making his own career in football at that time too. So I'd known Ian basically all my life. And Ian took over here in June 92. What many people don't know was that I was actually caretaker manager. I've had two spells as caretaker manager. And I was a caretaker manager in that spell for the month right before Ian took over. Now, it was the close season, you know, May to June 92. But players still had to be released. Players still had to be signed. You know, the mechanics had to still take place. And also, you don't want to miss out on signing potential targets that the previous manager might have had, for example. And then by the time a new manager comes in, and it was during that period in June 92 that I signed Jim Sherry, who went on to have a very successful career, captaining Livingston, for example, captaining Hamilton Accies, and he came back for a second spell. We won promotion of Division 3 in 2001, things like that. So Jim came back for a second spell here, is now a very successful football agent, or intermediary as they're called now. So I had a spell then, and I signed Jim Sherry, and George Foulston was the then club chairman. And Jim had just captained the under-18 team to winning the Scottish Amateur Under-18 Cup at Hampden Park. We'd beaten Clyde 3-1. And I was going to put Jim on a contract of £25 a week, you know, because he was doing quite early. He had a couple of wee things he was dabbling in on the side at that time too, and he had a job too. So he was going to be part-time initially and then going full-time. So I was paying him £25 a week and a £500 signing on fee, half now, half at Christmas. And I was trying to persuade the then chairman, George Foulston, who's still very involved locally at Blantyre-Vicks here with his family. Trying to persuade George Foulston this guy was worth signing at £25 a week. And George said, well, it's a bit of a commitment, you know, for the club. And on your head, be it, if it doesn't work out. We're allowed to think that his two spells at the club and his good career and his wholehearted style of play that Jim became a good signing.
Well, one thing we need to point out, especially for people who are Motherwell fans and try and make fun of Hamilton, Accies have won two cups. They've won the Challenge Cup twice. And you speak to any... You speak to any player that's won the Challenge Cup and they will tell you it is an important cup. And the fans will say as well, it was 2 years in a row in the early 90s. And some of the names that were in that Accies side, Colin Miller, of course, famous Canadian
Cup's
player.
Capped player.
Yeah. Andy Millen, who I think is still
playing, involved now at Morton.
Still playing at Morton, probably. Jim Weir.
Yep. Went to have a distinguished career too, particularly at St. Hearts and then St. Johnston.
Billy Reid.
Yep, who's had a very distinguished career, mainly as a coach since then, and famously with Graham Porter at Chelsea and Ostersunds and others in recent seasons, Brighton.
And a player that I always remember is Paul McDonald, who led down to Southampton. Yeah. He was just a fantastic winger.
Paul, yeah. I mean, I still see Paul regularly, and I still think of Paul. I think all Accies fans of a certain age will still think of Paul as that skinny wee winger we had back in 1986 and all the rest of it. It's never really changed. Paul was actually sold to Southampton in the same deal as Colin Cram. They both went together to Southampton in 1993, and Colin went on to have a particularly distinguished career too, mainly in the lower leagues in English football. But Colin is also a quiz question answer, and he's the only player, I think he remains the only player, to have played in all four Scottish leagues and all four English leagues, in addition to the Dutch Premier and the English Conference. And I was actually down in Bristol last week at Colin's wedding.
But you're telling me Accies has also led to periods of sustained success. Promotion in 2008, I think Billy Reid was the manager and then three seasons in the SPL, a couple of quarter-final appearances in the Cups as well. That was a time when Accies were booming, the youth setup was thriving, you were bringing players through. That must have been a memorable time.
It was, I mean, at one point we were seventh in the Premiership and higher points than sixth, just for the vagaries of how the split works and still does work. So we did extremely well that 2009-10 season, for example, with good players, flair players, playing really good football. And to have three successive seasons in the Premiership was fantastic, because prior to that, since the war, World War II, every time we'd been promoted, it was up one season and back down again in the 50s, in the 60s, and twice in the late 80s under John Lambie. Billy McLaren famously missed out on two goals, promotion goal difference, back up to the Premiership. That was when Ian Monroe then took over in 92. But it was about the 2008-2011 period, very, very successful, and then dropped down again 3 years back in the Championship. Alan Neil took us back up with the famous playoff victory at Mr. Road in 2014. And we then had seven successive seasons in the top flight. In many ways, just doing enough, you know, finishing 11th in playoffs or 10th or 9th as it happened to be, doing enough to avoid relegation each season. And also the COVID times hit us, lack of money, lack of investment, you know, you couldn't buy the players, all that kind of thing. Different things happened at that time too. The Premiership clubs got the chance of a COVID loan, but the Championship, League One, League Two clubs all got a gift of 500,000, 250,000. So a wee bit of warped in terms of how the money operated at that time as well. But the 2008-11 period, very, very successful. And then 2014-2021, 7 years. I mean, as an Accies fan of the 80s, and I'm sure most Accies fans of the 80s would have thought, to see have seven successive Premiership seasons wasn't as fantastic as it was, but wasn't something I ever thought that the club would achieve. But such was the financial stability at that time, built on the sales of the players that you've mentioned, you know, throughout the late and early 2010s. McCarthy, MacArthur, Brian Easton, Stephen Hendry, Greg Docherty, Michael Debb, the whole host of players came through and were sold on, you know, in that period and moved on to higher and better things and have had very good careers in football since.
One of the players that came through Accies was named best midfielder in Serie A, which is incredible.
Yeah, Lewis Ferguson is doing fantastic stuff. Currently injured, still keep in touch with Lewis. He's doing extremely well. And for as developed a player as he is right now, and as you say, the best midfielder in Serie A last season before his injury, when Lewis actually first came, he'd under 14s, 15s, he was still a skinny wee boy, and he was still having to be built up and developed. Teenagers all spurt at different times, as we know. And Lewis actually, for a spell, was having to play in the age group below, because he was still underdeveloped and not man enough. Yeah, for the 15s, when he was 15s, he was still playing 14s for part of the season. You know, which again, age is development too.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I really remember, the playoff win against Hibs, was the goal that made it 2-2, Tony Andrew.
Yeah.
I remember the guy that covered Accies at the time, Andy McGilvery, somebody we know really well, he texted me, he said, Hamilton have just picked up Tony Andrew, he's released by Livy, would you know about him? And I replied, Andy, he's the best player in the division, yeah. And he was sensational. Is he up in that kind of upper pantheon of Accies legends, along with Adrian Sprott, for his famous goal against Rangers?
Legends is always difficult to define. You're something kind of one good game or score five goals, things like that. Memorable players tend to maybe attract maybe the status legend too, whether they're maybe legendary or not. Tony Andrew had a fantastic spell at a particular period in time here and was crucial in some of the goals that we scored. And he had a fantastic record as a goal-scoring midfielder, for example, did really, really well as a goal-scoring midfielder. And that goal in the 90 plus four, I mean, I'd already moved down to the tunnel because we were more a goal up on the day, but 2-1 down in aggregate. So I'd moved down to the players' tunnel just to get ready, because also the TV, it was live in TV, they're going to want the manager for post-match and things like that. So I'd gone down from a seat in the stand to the player tunnel, just so I was ready to deal with all the immediate post-match hullabaloo that happens. So I was standing right at the tunnel when we scored the goal. So, wow, you know, fantastic, leaping up and down as you would, and into extra time. And then also we subsequently won it in penalties, which was fantastic. I think when Hibs had won the first leg here 2-0, and Hibs under Terry Butcher that season, they had a really dreadful run since the February. I think maybe the only one won it, one or maybe two games at most in that period. So Hibs were in a massive downward spiral. They needed a get up and go, get their mojo back sort of thing. And they won here 2-0, and they were 2-0 up. And that was their first, you know, their first win in a wee while, or maybe only the second win in a wee while. And so Hibs were truly buoyant ahead of the second leg, and maybe they just counted their chickens too much in advance.
One thing that I remember very vividly is the celebrations afterwards, because the police were called, because the team bus gets swarmed in the middle of the street outside the pub near the stadium. And the fans all spilled out and surrounded the bus. And I think the police get called to help kind of ease the congestion.
Maybe not quite so much as that. We did get away actually okay. But what we did do was we wanted a wee celebration, to help us. And the first task was to get across to the other side of Edinburgh. And of course, there's another team in Edinburgh on the other side of Edinburgh. So we pulled up, I think, at Tesco, not quite close to Tynecastle, and went in there just to, let's just say, buy some cans of lemonade for the players and that kind of thing for the bus journey back through here. Where the police and whatnot did get stopped, though, was here. Once we get back to Hamilton, I arranged to bring the bus back to the Academical Vaults pub just across the road from the stadium, where basically our fans' traditional pre- and post-match gathering point is. And the team, I'd alerted one or two people in the pub to know that the team bus was coming in. It would be there at 5:30 or whatever the time was. And they'd kept it quiet, so it was a surprise when the team bus duly rolled up outside the pub. Of course, the fans all spilled outside the pub. They blocked the three lanes of the road between the pub and Hamilton West railway station. There was partying, there was cars getting stopped. It was just a party atmosphere in the club. But the police then got called in just to help clear the traffic, not to stop the players partying. But it was one of these moments. We did it again after winning the Trust Trophy a couple of seasons ago as well. Brought the team bus back to the fans' pubs, because it's so important that they share in, you know, these things as well. We're all supporters. We don't get very many successes. And if your team bus suddenly pulls up outside the fans' gathering point, we had a couple of players on loan to, from English clubs and that kind of thing, and they'd never seen this before in their lives. You know, all of a sudden, they're out with their Snapchats and the filming in their phones. Here they were, walking off a team bus into the middle of a main road with about 500 Accies fans packed on it, and the blue lights forlornly tried to, can you be one of you, but please, we'll not have a party and all the rest of it. It was just good fun. It's one of these happy memories as a fan that you don't get to savour very much. Yeah, if you're Rangers or Celtic being in the Champions League the other night scoring 5-1, fantastic if you're a Celtic fan. But if you're a Hamilton Accies fan, it's getting a selfie with a player at 11:30 at night holding the Challenge Cup in the middle of Burnbank Road in Hamilton.
That's brilliant. Well, one of the extra roles that you have as well, and something you don't enjoy at all, and it's a big burden around your neck, is the work you do with UEFA. You told me you were in Seville recently, you're off to Galatasaray. Explain exactly what it is you do.
Yeah, I've got various roles for UEFA. UEFA have what's called a match delegate at every game, whether it's Women's Under-17s, Youth League, Men's Champions League, you know, International Matches, Nations League, whatever. There's a match delegate at every single UEFA game. People might know there's approximately 2,800 UEFA matches a season as well across all the competitions, so there's a heavy requirement for match delegates. And each national association, in our case the SFA, put forward people that they think are good enough for the role of match delegate. The match delegate is the highest UEFA authority at a game of football. The match delegate is there to oversee that the home club or the host country are organising the game of football safely, securely, in compliance with the competition regulations, that all the UEFA regulations are being adhered to in terms of safety, security, stadium infrastructure, medical kit, equipment, all these kind of things. And then the two teams are cooperating well together. The visiting team's training sessions are taking place okay, the hotel's fine, the players are happy, the food's okay. You're an overseer, you're a mixture of chairman, you're a mixture of diplomat, you're a mixture of detective. You're keeping an eye on the whole scenario from a UEFA point of view. Make sure that the two teams know the rules, they're not breaking the rules, the team lines are handed in on time, you know. Then it comes to the actual match, and there's lots of safety, security checks. pyrotechnics. We know what are a big issue right now. Pitch invasions, block stairways, political banners, objects thrown. And the delegate is there for a disciplinary and reporting function from UEFA's point of view with regard to that. He or she is the neutral person at the match that will give UEFA, your UEFA's eyes and ears at the game. They're in neon, they've got a room this size, a match centre, 24 TV screens, so they can see all that night, Champions League or Europa League nights taking place. So they might sometimes see something in the crowd before I've seen it, for example, and they'll send me a message or a telephone call. But you're there, eyes and ears on the ground, you're reporting back if there's any issues, anything that might threaten the game. A spectator could die at a game, a steward could die at a game, all sorts of things that could affect the daily control and running of the match. And you're there to oversee the whole thing, and then you've got a reporting function after the game as well.
You're a bit like a combination of the Queen and a restaurant critic. And the Queen was only ever shown places where people wanted her to see, and they made sure it was fairly well cleaned.
Yeah, well, I'm the opposite of that, because additionally, I work for UEFA as a stadium inspector. I also coach and mentor the new delegates coming through as well, and I also do the Standing Facility Observer programme. So there's various different roles. And what you said there, you know, seeing things that people only want you to see. When I remember doing a game in Poland one time, a Polish team against a Slovenian team in the qualifiers in the Europa League. So I'm doing my pre. Once the team lines have been handed in an hour and a half before the game, I then go out and said, I want to check the home hardcore fans' entrances. I want to check the away fans' entrances, because that's the areas. If there's going to be any trouble at the game, it's going to traditionally come in the home hardcore fans or the away fans. Not going to come in the family section or the VIP section. So I want to go and make sure that the fans are being body searched. As they told me, we always have a security meeting at 10:30 in the morning of the game, and there's body searches, ticket checks, scans. I want to make sure that the turnstiles are running smoothly, that the stewards are checking the fans, they're checking people's rucksacks and bags or whatever it happens to be, so that if there is any trouble or pirates during the game, I can say, well, there's a picture of body searches, but unfortunately there's a pink Bengal light high visibility flare at the same time, and then let the UEFA disciplinary services, you make their mind up and deal with it thereafter. So one game I was doing that in Poland, I've observed the body searches outside, and I've always got a liaison officer. Somebody could just, you know, open doors or drive you about just to make sure that things are, because I don't speak Polish, to kind of get this gate opened up, please, you know. So I've got somebody there to ensure I've got smooth passage. And sometimes too, it might just be myself and the liaison, but other times too, the stadium manager or safety officer or one of the policemen might accompany you just to protect your safety, or you're getting to the hardcore ultras fan, they might attack you in a UEFA suit. Well, fine, I'm a supporter as well. I know how fans behave, you know, so just, you know, let me deal with it.
This is just for fuck game.
So, I mean, so when I went at this game in Poland, so I've observed the fans being body searched outside, and I then said, can I go inside now? I just want to make sure that the ultras have got refreshment kiosks, toilet facilities, as good as the family section and all that. There's toilet paper and soap, all the basic things. They've got hot dogs and water and Coca-Cola. So they said, no, you can't go in there. I said, well, I want to go in there. You know, it's part of my job. I just want to make sure that they've been looked after inside. You know, I want to make sure that the ultras haven't got an absolute mess to walk into, and they've still got, or the away fans have got a mess to walk into. They've still got disabled spaces. They've still got access to clean toilets. You know, all the usual things. But you can't do that. I said, well, I need to do it. I'm going to do it. Why can't I do it? Well, it might be okay for you, but it's not safe for us. I thought, well, hold on. You're the chief of police. You're telling me you don't feel safe at your own ground. You know, that's a problem. Thanks very much. You can stay here, but I'll go inside. So it's just wee things like that, you know, and you get that quite a lot too. There was a major Champions League match, and there was an issue outside with the away fans all bizarrely taking off their trainers after they'd been searched and entered the ground. They all kept going to the toilets and taking off their trainers, which causing confusion and with the police and the stewards. They then found out that they were smuggling in the pyro in the heels of their trainers and things like that. And the pyro basically the size of biro pens. They're not big. Some of them, the smoke ones, are the size of 50 pence pieces. Some of them, they're not big, easily smuggled in. So I've gone down there and I'm standing in amongst the middle of these away fans, because they're all looking at me in the UEFA suit, and I'm thinking, listen, guys, calm down the pyro. You know, but you're here to enjoy the game. You want to be, you know, safely travelling back to your own city, your own country tomorrow. You want to spend the night in an Italian jail or whatever it happens to be, sort of thing. You know, let's just behave ourselves. Another time too at Hajduk Split, again, famous team in Croatia, old Yugoslavia, traditional Torcida Ultras fan group, one of the original 1950 they were found fan groups in Europe. But when I was there, it was the playoff round, second leg, and there were various disciplinary sanctions at all the qualification rounds throughout July and August for various things like pyrotechnics, blocked stairways, poor organisation, no body search. There were various things that have gone wrong at their qualification rounds, so I thought, no, let's just work with them. Let's just try and make it well. So I've dealt with the club president, the club supporter liaison people. But let's just try and have a clean, free game that we can enjoy. Let's try and prove to the Croatian FA and prove to UEFA that your fans can behave. Let's have, you know, no blocks there. Let's have no pitch invasions today. Well, it's difficult, blah, blah, blah. So in fairness to the club, they took out full-page adverts in the local paper for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. You know, UEFA sent this so-and-so from Scotland. He's going to be on the ball today. We need to make sure everything's fine. You know, can the fans please behave and all the rest of it? So the club are very proactive in that manner. So on the day of the game, we've had a security meeting on the morning. And after the meeting finished, I've just looked out the window and I can see the hardcore fans setting up their TIFO in the stand behind the goal, the various coloured red and white flags for the players to come out to and all the rest of it. So I've walked over there and there's, you know, the four or five big absolute bruisers there. With some of the kids helping, decorate the stand with the TIFO. I said, guys, can I get a nice clean game today? Can it make sure, please, there's no pyro? This is my birthday today. I said, see you after the game. I want to have a beer with the referee and a pizza with the referee. Just to relax after the match, you know. Whenever the game finishes at midnight, so I think I want a beer and a pizza after the game. It's my birthday. Can I enjoy my birthday? Oh, Mr. Delegate, this is Croatia. Of course we have pyro. I said, I know it's your fan culture, but see, today, I don't want to be up all night emailing pictures and reports off to UEFA. I'd like a nice, quiet, peaceful night. It's my birthday. I want to enjoy my birthday and a beer. Can I make sure, please, there's no pyro today, no blocks there. Let's prove you can behave. Let's try and get a game where you don't get fined off UEFA. And he looks at me strangely and goes, we will discuss this. So the ultras went into a wee huddle and they discussed this bizarre request from this idiot from UEFA that said no pyro in Croatia tonight. And they came back to me, shook my hand. Mr. Delegate, tonight for you, there'll be no pyro. And they were true to their word. They were absolutely fantastically behaved, with no pyro, with no block staircases, no pitch invasions. That's what you're engaging with them. Your pitch, birthday, beer, you want a beer. Let's come here, all of us to enjoy your night sort of thing. And that was my story of Hajduk Split.
Maybe it's because you're a Scottish delegate, if you're like a Serbian delegate the night of...
I know, yeah.
Well, you've got a very important role on match day. You're quite visible during the day. If it's a home game here at New Douglas Park, what are the different stages of your role do you go through?
On a match day, you're hosting a home game. The same with UEFA too. If you're hosting a home game, your guests are the visiting team and the referees. You want to make sure the visiting dressing room and the referee room are all clean, tidy, set up for them. In the referee's room, I always put in, you know, their water, their Lucozade drinks, their grapes, cereal bars, that kind of thing. And I always give them, you know, Turnips, Camel, wafers too, because it's local to us and me being an Unnington boy. Whenever I do my UEFA games as well, I always give a gift to the referees and the observer and the other UEFA staff working with me and my liaison. They get a keyring and an 80-pack of Turnips as well, sort of thing, because it's a wee local gift. Just to thank them for helping me on my trip.
So the referees, you put out some fruit for the guide dogs as well?
No. The referees all get their own. Obviously, nowadays, you know, wee teams bring their own isotonics and... Lucas bars and all sorts of deer nose stuff that the sports scientists deal in nowadays. Things we never had 25 years ago. So I'm normally here about 9:30, 9:45 on a Saturday morning, just getting the place ready, just checking things like toilet rolls are all in place and things like that, and then just checking the pitch is fine, corner flags, the toilets, just generally making sure that all the organisations in place for the game, dealing with some of the other staff, match day staff that are arriving early as well. Then at 11:30, I'll maybe telephone the manager and get the teams to start to, you know, hold up the team lines and that kind of thing. And then just keep it saved and then really not do anything with it until 1:30. First of all, to make sure they've all arrived safely and make sure there's no last-minute injuries or anyone's taken ill at the last minute or that kind of thing, you know, which happens a lot more than people would think. For example, you know, the number of last-minute changes you get or traffic delays, you know, that we all know that Central Scotland can be like sometimes with traffic. Just takes one snarl up in the M8 and when we're all snookered. You know, that happens maybe once or twice a season, the team's 30 minutes late or whatever it happens to be. So basically it's all this match preparation. I always put out the medical trolley behind the home dugout, so it's there. We've got a spare medical trolley and a spare defib in addition to the ones that the paramedics bring too, for example. So just to make sure that everything is there and in place. Any emergencies, well, that's there. We're in the stadium control room just now. So again, the safety officers and the stewards, they all know where they're going and the arrangements are all made. And you know, I just basically act as the link between everybody involved in a match day. I don't have to do everything because there's far, far too many things to do. But at least I know that it's done or who's going to do it. I just look after my wee bits to make sure that the dressing room corner basically and the players are fine and any last minute issues or my granny's arrived from Canada or whatever it happens to be, you know. It's just sort out all the daft wee things and the wee niggles that happen on a match day and sort of try and resolve them all.
You're often seen down the tunnel as well when the game's in progress. it can be quite excitable and heated down there. Have you ever witnessed any flashpoints, or have you been part of any?
Yeah, loads over the years. I remember one time we were playing Livingston when we were ground sharing at Clifton Hill, and it was Sandy Clark for us and Jim Leishman for Livingston manager. And Livy had a player sent off, Stevie, I forget his surname now, but became a good coach at Dundee and a few others, defender. And he'd been sent off, and he was more than taking his time coming off the park. And Jim Leishman was lambasting him for being sent off while he was still walking off the park. So the player stops on the field of play and starts having a shouting match with Jim Leishman, and he's still 10 yards on the park. And of course, the referee's trying to shoo the player off the park. The player's standing there giving it jip to Jim Leishman. Jim shouting back up. And Sandy Clark comes in, you know, get off the bloody park so we continue with the game. So I think we're trying to play a game of football, you. And the Livy player, you shut up, I'm arguing with my own management and all the rest of it. I'm thinking, I had to go on the park. Listen, pal, you're going to have to come off. You've been sent off. I had to go on the park, put my arm round the player and throw him off, but to the standing ovation from the crowd from doing it. Another time too, when Ali Dawson was the manager, we were ground sharing at Firhill this time against Brechin, and Dick Campbell was the Brechin manager. And Dick Campbell's legendary in dugouts, as everybody knows too, and he's got his own cult and his own aura and everything else. And there was a shouting match between Ali Dawson and Dick Campbell, and it was getting heated, and it did cross a line, and they weren't coming to blows, but it was above and beyond the behaviour you'd expect in the technical areas. So I just took 2 paces forward, turned round, faced them both, and shouted, "Gentlemen, your own dugout, sit down." And the two of them looked at me, sat down. It was just wee things, but yeah, you do get caught up in things too. I'm a supporter. If we go up with them, she's not going to, you know, politely clap or whatever. And that upset Jim Gannon, the Motherwell manager, one time, because he just thought the guy standing at the dugout was a steward. And all of a sudden, you know, when I cheered Hamilton 2-1 up against Motherwell, and what the hell are you doing? You're a steward. I'm not a bloody steward. I'm the club secretary. I'm a Mackey's fan. You shouldn't be standing here, blah, blah. You shouldn't be cheering going to the dugout. I said, get off. You deal with your players. I'll deal with my team sort of thing. And then a few minutes later, it's the end of the game, 87 minutes sort of thing. So I've turned to go up the tunnel. I always go and open up the tunnel door so they're ready for the referee blowing full time. Unlock the referee's door so when they come in, they're straight into the room and that kind of thing. So I've turned to walk up the tunnel, open up the tunnel door, put the wedge in place. And if I've done that, Motherwell have equalised. And all of a sudden, I'm unlocking the referee's door. I'm aware of this man charging up the tunnel. You're not cheering now, are you? You're not cheering now. And there was Jim Gannon standing behind me as I'm unlocking the referee door. And I'm thinking, excuse me, you're the manager of the Motherwell. I'm out there and celebrate with your own team. I'm doing my job in here. But he thought, because of where I was standing, that I was a steward.
I was actually here for that match. Yeah. And I remember the aftermath for it. It was quite funny.
Yeah, it was. Again, it's just, you've all got roles to perform, and my role is just to be I'm just basically the diplomat to try and make sure people are behaving and all the rest of it.
You've worked with a few boards in your time. Boards are always criticised by fans. Were there executives at Accies who very much loved the club and wanted the best?
All boards do, because all good, whether it's their own money they're investing, their own time, I think everyone's got an affection and a feeling for the club that they're at. There are those some directors that have always been naturally fans of the club and have been growing up at the club too. Alistair Duguid, famously in the 80s and 90s, was a director of the club and had been a fan all his days too. Businessman in Strathaven. Other directors come in simply because they're local businessmen and they want to be seen to do well, and it promotes their own businesses too and that kind of thing. But they may not have been natural Hamilton Accies fans, but were, you know, prominent local businessmen. Others like the late Jim Watson, who certainly was latterly much, much reviled by the supporters. But Jim was a Hamilton Accies fan all his days since he was a boy as well, and you can't take that away from him. Although latterly, he was part of the split with the boards that we had at that time too in the 90s that led to the homelessness for such a long period. But they all had their own ideas, and basically my job is to work with the board, but I've always been more of a football man, and you work with the players in the dressing room. The job's always been sort of to protect the dressing room first and foremost, because without the dressing room, you've not got a game on a Saturday at 3 o'clock. You know, that's what I always say. One of the crucial roles, right back at the start of the interview, one of the crucial roles of the club secretary is to give the manager little to worry about come 3 o'clock on a Saturday as possible. He's only got the easy task of winning a game of football. Whereas I just need to make sure that what John Rankin's got at 3 o'clock tomorrow, you know, is fine and hunky-dory. Then it's up to him to do his work and, you know, the working out in the pitch and all the work they put in during the week, and it should be smooth and easy on a match day. That's your ultimate role and the ultimate aim. And it doesn't finish at 5 o'clock either. You know, you're here to make sure that the referee's okay, you find everything okay, right? Once they're out, the young boys are going to get the rooms cleaned, the away dressing room is cleaned, and they want to make sure the young boys are all the duties. Then it takes us to about 6 o'clock, quarter past six, and we can, you know, lock up and finish the end half past six on a match day. Make sure you're leaving it clean and tidy again, because once we leave it clean and tidy on a Saturday, the under-14s are playing here at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, the under-6s are playing at noon, the ladies are playing at 4 o'clock. You know, it's a constant cycle. And in the days of Hamilton are away, Clyde are at home. But before Clyde are home at 3 o'clock, the under-13s are playing at 9, the 15s are playing at 11. You know, it's a constant cycle. So it's requiring, you know, basic things like toilet rolls. Someone's going to check, make sure that they're there for the next game. It's just wee things like that. So before I go away on a Saturday, if we're away and Clyde are here, I make sure there's spare toilet rolls in every toilet. The daft wee things, but you don't want somebody, oh, I've run out of toilet paper and Hamilton away at Kirkcaldy sort of thing. You know, it's just make sure that the arrangements are all in place for anybody to have a smooth game. And then we do a lot here, but because of the artificial pitch, because of the huge car park we've got, it's an ideal venue for the amateur FA. They play the Scottish Amateur Cup semi-finals here. We do the West Cups, things like that. So I do 7 or 8 games a season for the amateur FA. We help, you know, promote their games to promote that level of football, which is absolutely vital in the game. You know, many players have started out at amateur football or later in their careers will still play amateurs, over 35s, over 40s. East Kilbride YM, local amateur team here, for example, over 35s. Davey Winters, Robbie Winters, Ricky Waddle, you know, former players here, things like that. You know, really prominent players still playing at that level of football. And they enjoy it. Because amateur football is all about enjoying it. They're not going to win the World Cup in an amateur game. They don't have like Ronaldo or Messi or Guardiola at their games. Amateur football is all about enjoying it, whether it's 9 o'clock, 2 o'clock, Saturdays, Sunday leagues. You're not going to win anything. You're not going to win the World Cup. So let's not aspire to that. Just go out there and enjoy it with your pals. You know, if you get beat 10-0, you've lost 10-0. Well, beat after the game and 10-0, you'll beat 10-0 next week. Amateur football is about players, especially post-COVID players, mental health, players enjoying themselves, team bonding after games. It's not about some teams will win trophies. You're going to win the Scottish Cup, you'll win the West of Scotland Amateur, whatever it happens to be, you'll win the local amateur league. Great for the teams involved. But it's more about the involvement, the camaraderie, the fitness, and still playing football, which the Scottish passion, as we know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you really don't understand, but the power that I have with this podcast is unlimited. And tomorrow I'm making you the chief executive of the SFA. What ideas would you implement if I did that?
Run it through me again, sorry.
So tomorrow morning, yeah, you're going to become the chief executive of the SFA.
Huh?
What ideas have you got?
If I were the chief executive of the SFA, it's got to be... First of all, you're overseeing all Scottish football, whether it's Wick Academy or Stranraer, whether it's Berwick Rangers or Glasgow Rangers, you know, whether it's Burnt Island Shipyard or, you know, or Morton. Every team counts, and that's the most important thing. Yes, the Premiership teams are the ones that are generating the TV revenue, the commercial deals, the Scottish national team, the women's team, qualifying for Euros and finals tournaments. That's what's bringing in the money into Scottish football. Well, that money's got to trickle down to Thornybridge, you know, to Dunrise. It's got to trickle down to the amateur FA, to the schools FA, to the youth FA, the women's. Everybody's going to get their appropriate drip down feed from that. And that's absolutely vital. I mean, the one thing that we lack greatly in Scotland still are training facilities. Artificial pitches, great here having one at Hamilton Accies, but I mean, amateur games, youth academy matches tend to take place at local school Astros or city or council run artificial pitches, be it Hamilton Palace Grounds or Tory Glen at Glasgow, wherever it happens to be. You know, Michael Woods through in Glenrothes and Fife, the Orium in Edinburgh. You know, but there's still not enough. You've got to see, every week you see an amateur game get postponed in Edinburgh or Aberdeenshire or Ayrshire because lack of facilities or lack of referees. You know, or games off this week, we don't have enough referees. But you've added, you know, 10 amateur teams to your league. If we need 5 more referees by instant definition, you know, you just can't say add 10 teams and say, great, we've got 30 teams in the league. You've only got 10 referees. You've only played 10 games. You know, so it's about driving up, being aware of what needs to be done. We have to increase more training facilities. We greatly need more indoor venues. You've got Tory Glen, you've got Ravenscraig, Orium, I think there's one up in Aberdeen as well, Aberdeen Sports Village too. We greatly need more indoor venues in Scotland. That costs money, whether it's government, whether it's lottery money. So we've got to be engaging in that, and I'm quite sure the SFA are. But I mean, there should be an indoor venue in Gala Shield. There should be one in Glenrothes. There should be one in Fort William. There should be one in Inverurie. They shouldn't be just confined to Glasgow, Edinburgh, you know, Motherwell, etc., the Central Belt, albeit the population's there. But I mean, you have to develop. There's a huge hole, and if you look at a map of Scotland and place all the football grounds on it, you've got a huge hole between Fort William, Inverness, Ullapool, Cape Wrath. You know, that North West Highlands area has got a fantastic, thriving amateur league, summer leagues, Northwest Southern League in Manchester, at least. There's Sleet and Strath, West Highland Amateur FA up there as well. Mallig's got a wee team. But they're all playing artificial pitches or grass pitches. But these teams are as vital as your Rangers, Celtics, Aberdeens, Hibs, Hearts, etc. are, you know, at the top level of the game, because no football's going to exist without grassroots. You know, it's got to trickle down. And when the SFA have to appreciate that, yeah, it's the league's job to run leagues. Neil Doncaster's job to run the SPFL. It's the Lowland League to run theirs, the Highland League to run theirs, the West of Scotland, the East, the South, the North, the Juniors, the Midlands. Everybody's got their own areas to look after. But the SFA have got the overall, overseeing, overarching role to govern all of Scottish football and to make sure that everyone's been looked after. There's a natural huge dominance in the big teams and the national team because that's generating the money. That's absolutely vital. But you've got to make sure that Wick Academy get their fair wee share of Scotland's, you're qualifying for the Euros too. Whether that's contribution towards a new training ground in Wick, or a bag of balls or a set of strips under 12 team in Wick or Burnt Island or Wigtown, whatever it happens to be, everybody should be getting something from Scotland qualifying from the Euros. You should be engaging more with everybody. You know, Willie Colm's been received extremely well by players, fans and media alike in the last couple of weeks. Speaking of refereeing matters and VAR, because still there's a lot of misunderstanding and a genuine lack of knowledge in many people. We all think we know VAR. We all think many people you steal here shouting, oh, last man, send him off. There is not, never has been a last man rule. Yet it's still the most common thing you hear on a Saturday, whether it's from media or a player or a coach saying, oh, ref, he's a last man, he's a last man. Well, sorry, folks, there is no last man rule. We've never had a last man rule. It's denying, in the referee's view, a clear and obvious goal scoring opportunity. Whether you're the last man or the third last man, if you're clean through and goal, you know, and there might still be two defenders rushing in for you, neither here nor there. There's no last man rule. It's a common misconception. So it's just correcting, well, the column's correcting wee things like that. You know, you should have, if there's a major issue in a match at the weekend, then the SFA should be saying, listen, folks, here's what happened. Here's why it's happened. Or here's the reasons behind this disciplinary decision. Here's the reasons why a certain manager got a 4-game ban. You know, he had a previous record. It's his third time this season. People just think, oh, Joe Bloggs has done this, he's got a 4-game ban, or he would shout at the referee. Well, it might be the third time this season he shouted at the referee, and that's why he's got a 4-game ban. It's escalated. It's just wee things like that to smooth things over, to appease people, to know why decisions happen or how decisions happen. Because I've been in the SFA disciplinary committee for 22 years. You have been involved in many of the high-profile...
How much trouble have you been in?
I mean, I think I'm the longest-serving member in the disciplinary committee, as was the judicial panel now, and it's just, again, your years of experience, your knowledge of how the game works in Scotland, and past sanctions, past precedents, how it all works.
One thing I want to ask, I was taking a look at the census data, and surprisingly, Hamilton seems to have a larger population than Motherwell. Can Accies ever draw the crowds to rival Motherwell? Because Motherwell seem to have accelerated away from the 70s in terms of the people they're able to draw in.
I don't really think so. And top populations too. I think Wishaw and Wish's conurbations, I think, are also, again, larger than Motherwell. I didn't know that Hamilton was larger than Motherwell. Ishkill Brown, obviously, very local and enlarging too. I think Motherwell historically have always been a top division team, historically. Hamilton have always historically been a second-tier team. If you look over even the last 50 years, last 100 years, Hamilton's natural position in Scotland's always been in the upper half of the second tier, ups, downs, as all teams have. Motherwell have been down in the second tier on a few occasions, never been as down as the third. In recent years, I think Motherwell have always been a top division team, always been a bigger team. I think Hamilton, and I'm not really sure why, Hamilton, maybe more than Motherwell, has always suffered. West of Scotland, Rangers, Celtic, everything else. Weird away, no matter where you are, even going down to Stranraer, when Hamilton are away at Stranraer, you pass all the Ulster buses heading. You know, it's just the way football is. And whether Hamilton have suffered more from people heading towards Glasgow or their games than Motherwell, I'm not quite sure. I think it's maybe just Motherwell's historic top division dominance and natural higher placing over the years. It's always been a big industrial area too, with the Ravenscraig and the other, you know, industries from Motherwell too. And Motherwell is a collection of, you know, even with Wishaw beside it, adding in your Mains and Cambers, Nethins and Holy Towns and Moss Ends and Bells Hills too, there's a big industrial area of Motherwell, maybe slightly more than Hamilton. Hamilton, yeah, and looking maybe towards Blantyre, Rutherglen, Uddingston, Bells, you know, maybe that side of it as well. I think Motherwell's just had a natural, more top division dominance over the years, more maybe of an industrial supporter and fan base too.
You ready for some quick questions?
No, we'll try our best.
Best player you've seen in an Accies shirt?
Oh, dear me. Lots of good players. The most naturally gifted of recent years certainly was James McCarthy, who's a fantastic player. He's probably out in that field just now, actually. He's been in training with us in recent weeks just to keep himself taken over. James is a wonderfully gifted player. Playing at the same time as James, though, was Tony Stevenson, another midfielder. Didn't get the same airs and graces as James got, and Tony's still playing now, you know, at junior, lower league level, that kind of thing. But what a fantastic array of passes Tony had. And going back to the early 80s, I've always tended to like the battling midfielder type of player, the one that goes in, hits your ankle, and all the rest of it. People like over the years, Neil Howie, Stevie Clark, Billy Reid as a player, Jim Sherry, two others, people that battled away for the team. Scott Martin, the current captain, just now is an example of that as well. Well, those are the players that I've always tended to like and appreciate their style of play rather than, you know, your goal-scoring centre-forwards or things like that. But equally, two of the best players in the last 50 years at the club have been goalkeepers, Ricky Ferguson, and then a few years later succeeded by Alan Ferguson. And between the two of them, you know, the best part of 900 appearances for the club, which in the current modern era is highly unlikely ever to be surpassed.
You work as a player liaison as well. Has there ever been a player who was just an absolute gentleman that you really wanted to succeed in the game?
Oh, there's loads. I mean, players, as human beings do, we're all entirely different characters. Some easy to get on with, some harder to get on with, some quiet, want their own space, some are the jack, the lad, some are the life and soul of the parties. All my closest friends in life and all my best friends are all current or fast football players. The vast majority of them have been players here at Hamilton Accies. We've still got a WhatsApp chat group, for example, in the under-18 team from 2001. They're still active, you know, every day, every week, just shitting messages and football banter and stories and all the rest of it. Without players, you've not got a team. Yeah. And the players have to be of good mind, and the manager helps that too. I try and do my wee bit as well. When I famously got a wee biscuit drawer in my office, sometimes players just didn't like lunch that day, and they want a Mars bar or a Penguin biscuit or whatever. Or they've missed breakfast and they want a wee sugar shot before training and that kind of thing. Sometimes people want to come in and sit down and discuss a problem with you. So if there's a biscuit drawer that brings them in, thanks, Scott, I've got a Penguin biscuit, and I'm away, I'll say, can I sit there and talk to you about something? And the biscuit drawer gets them in, and then they start coming up with a problem. How can I help it? Or it could be a mortgage issue or a personal issue, whatever it happens to be. And I try and help them a wee bit or pin something off for them or arrange a car insurance, whatever it happens to be, just try to do that for them. But there was famously a few years ago, Martin Canning was signing a player, and it was a player's second spell at the club. So he's met the player at a hotel to discuss the usual things, wages, length of contract, all the rest of it. And the player stops Martin Canning and says, stop, has Scott still got his biscuit drawer? And the manager goes, yeah, he has, why? Okay, I'll sign. And that was it. He wasn't interested in how long a contract it was, or maybe even £500 a week. So the manager agreed the deal and shook hands, and he's back to his car and says, what's this biscuit drawer? And I had to go and explain to him what it was, and it was just a wee chatting point for me and a player with a problem or that kind of thing, and the player came back and Julie got his Penguin biscuit.
You've been to quite a lot of grounds. What's your favourite stadium you've ever visited?
Every stadium is totally different. You've got fantastic new modern arenas like Tottenham in England, for example, the new Juventus, another fantastic stadium as well, Qatar for the World Cup, which I didn't go to, but I was in Qatar in January for the Asian Championships, out watching games there. Some fantastic stadiums in Qatar now. In Europe, countries like Turkey, Poland, Israel, Georgia, Slovakia, heavily invested in stadiums in recent years, you know, through hosting UEFA 21s or for Euros, that kind of thing. There's been a huge stadium building in these countries too. And Britain, which led the way in stadium development in the 80s and 90s, Britain unfortunately had the disasters of Bradford or Birmingham. There was the Heysel in Brussels win too, with the Liverpool fans, etc. Ibrox from the 70s. Britain suffered through the Safety Sports Grounds Act in 75. Britain developed from that. And by the time of England hosting Euro 96, Britain had then Ernie Walker, the former SFA secretary. He was the UEFA security, or stadium and security committee chairman at that time. And Ernie had overseen the stadiums for Euro 92 in Sweden, 96 in England, Euro 2000 all in Belgium, the new fancy Braga stadium at Euro 2004 in Portugal. Ernie had overseen on UEFA's behalf the development of the stadiums in these countries for hosting the major events. And Ernie, I remember saying in 1996, said pound for pound, England and Britain and in general, Scotland too, with our new developed stadiums, pound for pound are the best stadiums in Europe. But in recent years, say with his massive building programs elsewhere, standards have naturally modernised over the years too. So the new Tottenham, new Juventus, certainly fantastic stadiums. But then there's other stadiums, older stadiums that are still fantastic. Some of your former communist Eastern European stadiums, many of which are unchanged, but some of them, a lot of them are modernising too. Red Star Belgrade in Serbia, Osijek in Croatia, the old CSKA Sofia, the old Bulgarian Army Stadium in Bulgaria, which is just it's about to be or is being demolished this year, I think. Fantastic old historic stadiums. I mean, if you're a child of the 70s and 80s, these were team names that you only saw on the paper on a Thursday when you saw the European results. There was no internet or TV or WhatsApp to look at CSKA Sofia playing, you know, whoever it was, Legia Warsaw back in those days. You simply got the result in the paper and that was it. So these were always distant teams, fantastic names, you know, CSKA Sofia or Spartak Moscow or Guardia Warsaw, you know, things like that. And then all of a sudden now in the internet age, you can be football manager, you can be managing these teams, or you can watch some Slovan Bratislava playing at Celtic the other night, for example. These are all fantastic names of the past. And these old grounds in Eastern Europe are full of fantastic memories and culture. Because for a child of the 70s, you've read of CSKA Sofia, wow, what kind of a team are they? And maybe you'd see them playing at Celtic or Rangers or Hearts or whatever in a European game in the 80s. You're thinking, oh, there's Dynamo Kiev. You know, Soviet champions as they were in those days, fantastic teams. Nine of the Dynamo Kiev players were in the Soviet national team and so on. And it's fantastic to see these teams, but their grounds, as a football fan, someone that loves stadiums, it's the much the character and the use of the ground as well as the people that are in it or the modern facilities it has. I was doing an inspection in Ireland a few years ago. They were going to be hosting the UEFA Under-19 Championships. And there was a ground in Ireland that the team were historically a youth academy type team. They produced many, many players to play for Republic of Ireland or move to England, play for the top teams, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, etc. in England. But the ground was lower league, Irish standard. It wasn't up to UEFA's modern standard for hosting an international match. But you know, with some improvements and some, you know, some nudges here and there, some shortcomings, you know, for example, it's only 2 metres from the touchline to the brick wall behind the goals. So any goalie diving back, he was at risk of banging his head in a brick wall and things like that. Now, how it's allowed domestically, I don't know, but let's just get a bed mattress, for example, and stick it in front of the wall and protect the goalie if he does dive back. And we did enough to get this team, you know, let's just say Sweden v Denmark here in the Under-19. It's only going to have 150 people or 200 people. Let's see if we can get that game at this ground. You know, and it's working with teams too as to why they have to improve their stadiums. You know, you meet obstacles. I did an awful lot of work at both Red Star Belgrade, Partizan Belgrade, to try and modernise their stadiums, to get them ready for the modern group stages that we have nowadays and all the TV, the broadcast requirements. It's huge at that day. That's what's bringing the money into the game. So you've got to make sure you've got the safety and security, the control room, the CCTV. You've got to make sure you've got the ability to deliver the game and broadcast it to all the people and showcase all the sponsors around Europe. You want to see the Heineken, the Continentals, you know, they all want value for the money. They want to see their LED boards in pristine positions, filled with flags, their ultras, banners draped all over them, covering them all up. So you've really got to work with stadiums, work with clubs to make sure these things happen so that everybody and they get the benefit.
What's the worst mistake you've made as an administration?
I think it was the very first year that we went to 3 subs. You could have 2 subs. We had 2 subs. It was always 1 sub up when it started in the 60s. Then it became 2 subs in the 70s. And then it was the early 90s we got to, wow, 3 subs. But I think for a season, first of all, it was 2 subs plus a goalie. And then it became the 3 subs. And the 2 subs plus a goalie, it was our under-18 goalie, was named on the bench for the League Cup tie against Dundee United. And the under-18s hadn't yet signed all the new youth forms for that season yet. You know, it was the first game of the season, the League Cup at the start of August, I think. And I had, even though the goalie had been with us for 16s, 17s, 18s, that kind of thing, he hadn't yet signed his new form for the new season as the under-18 goalie. And it was the following day, the league phoned up and said, "You do realise you played an unregistered, a trialist goalie in your cup tie last night?" I thought, "What do you mean? He's been with us for the last 3 years." I'm thinking, haven't they renewed his form? And We'd lost in the game anyway, but there was still £100 suspended fine. You know, it was the newness of the sub goalie rule and just forgetting to mention the player and that kind of thing. There's been one or two like that over the years. You know, 30 or 40 odd years, there've been a couple of. Yeah, I've never had a suspended player play, which is needed, but there was that one that probably was the main one that I would identify, you know, as a registration. An error that's solely the responsibility of the club secretary. You know, it's your job to know that. It's your job to have the players sign. Your job to have the players able to play free of suspension, that kind of thing.
Well, finally, one memory that always makes me smile at New Douglas Park is when Michael Stewart got sent off and he fell down the tunnel. What's a football memory that always makes you chuckle?
To be fair, it was my fault that happened. It was me that led to Michael Stewart booting that ball, and I'll tell you why. Because that match was a massive learning curve for us too. It was our first season back in the Premier League, and the Sky had, they always do their immediate post-match interview in a wee room and hand over the man of the match, champagne, that kind of thing. Well, the wee room they did that in was just in our players' tunnel, but next to the referee room. So that room was in there as well. So because of that, there were TV wires coming up the tunnel, wiring into the wee room where they were going to be filming the man of the match presentation. So such was the thickness of these TV cables, I had to wedge open my tunnel door. I couldn't get my tunnel door closed because of the thickness of these cables. And there had been, obviously, the players line up at the tunnel to start the game and walk out onto the pitch. And obviously, they've got their wee glucose sachet or a bottle of water or something as they go onto the pitch, and they just discard it. And there had been a discarded bottle of water lying in the player's tunnel, and I thought, I must pick it up, put it in the bin. And I must have walked past it five or six times when Michael Stewart got sent off. So Michael Stewart gets sent off. My job then is to open up the tunnel door so I don't hear player, you know, kicking doors out there. You've got the tunnel ranting and raving. So one tunnel door was wedged open with the camera, with the TV wires anyway. I then opened up the other tunnel door and put a wedge there so Michael Stewart can walk up the tunnel without kicking doors and go into a tantrum. And of course, the TV gantry is directly opposite the tunnel doors. So the TV gantry had a perfect head-on view of Michael Stewart walking up the tunnel. And did Michael Stewart not go and see this bottle of water on the ground that I'd failed to pick up? Booted the bottle of water, slipped in his arse and landed in his backside, thinking, oh, I've got away with that. Nobody's seen it, but of course it was live on BBC, that the TV cameras had it. And later on in that game, there was a massive stramash, a big brouhaha at the dugouts as the referee blew for full time. There was fighting at the dugouts, fighting in the tunnel. I'm standing, as I always do, at the corner apex of the tunnel to see everybody coming off the pitch and see everybody go up to the dressing rooms, make sure that everything, you know, goes smoothly. And it's kicked off in the tunnel. There was everybody having a go at everybody else. Dumfries, you go this way, you go that way, and all the rest of it. And it ended up with, mayhem from a refereeing perspective, with six red cards, after the game too, between coaches and players. Campbell Ogilvie was the heart secretary that day, and I was there. And Campbell's got brought in with this player, and I got brought in with that coach, and Campbell got brought in with this coach, and I got brought in with that player. All to say, if you're getting a red card, and you're getting a red card, and all the rest of it. It was just one of these mayhem games. But you see, Michael Stewart famously fell over with a bottle of water that I'd failed to pick up. If I'd picked up the bottle of water, he would never have fallen over.
Well, on that honest bombshell, that brings us to the end of another episode of the CSI Football Podcast. I'm going to go with Scott. He's going to take his shirt off and show me his Scotland tattoos where we eat biscuits out of his biscuit drawer. Join us again for another episode of a forensic journey into the annals of Scottish football. Scott, thank you very much.
No problem. Gentlemen. Pleasure.